Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast. I think this is number 90, if I've read it right. Here today with regular contributors, Sean Byers and Stuart, both famous authors in their own right, of course. Sean of the famous book about Sean Murray, Republican leader and communist. And of course, Stuart McGill, author of Roaring Red Front, a really good book, trying to get your hands on it. Looks into, well, you can tell us a bit later about that, Stuart. I'll give you 30 seconds at the end to plug your book. But today we're not here to talk about their books. We're here to talk about debt. We're all in it. Government's in it, private sector's in it. And so what is debt and why are we all in it is sort of the theme of today. We could talk for hours about this, but I'm limiting it to 35, 40 minutes as usual. Because we're doing debt, I have to mention, of course, David Graeber and his great book on debt, The First 5,000 Years of Debt. You don't have to agree with everything in it, but you have to recognise that it's the breadth and the depth of what is an outstanding piece of work. And particularly the thing that interests me the most out of it, I think, is the anthropological and historical focus that he brings to understanding the power that debt has on societies across time. Its kind of moral hold it has, its ethical hold it has on us, and its ability to discipline us and make us do things that are almost inhumane. Just before I start, I'll tell a story that he tells in the book, which is really interesting and revealing. He tells a story about an anti-malaria program in Madagascar. And he's having a conversation with a really well-meaning, nice, kind of middle-class NGO type. And at that time, the government was forced to cut its anti-malarial program because the IMF insisted, International Monetary Fund, insisted that what money it had to use it to pay off its debts to the IMF. The consequence was the deaths of up to 10,000 men, women and children. And when David Graeber explained this story to this nice NGO person, her response was simply, but sure, everyone has to pay their debts. And that response was telling because it kind of gives justification for the preventable deaths of thousands of people so that already rich people can become richer off of a debt that maybe should never have been issued in the first place. And it makes it seem perfectly reasonable. And it's a great example of the hold debt has over us as a concept, and that concept that we have to pay down our debts. And we want to talk a bit about that today, because paying your debts almost excuses death, war, violence, you know, colonization. And yet, and this is important, it's almost a taboo subject in some parts of economics. Or it's misrepresented, or it's misunderstood, or there are deliberate lies told about it and its function in capitalist societies. I mean, it struck me as incredible, and I know we've talked about this before, lads, that before the global financial crash, debt and credit weren't even part of the forecast models of mainstream economies. So they almost literally didn't see the tide wave of debt that crashed the economy coming. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I'll go to you first, Sean. Personal reflection, maybe a little bit. What about debt? What does it mean to you? And when did you realize how important it was in your coming to terms with and learning about political economy and how to read the economy?
Yeah, I think for us, it's a financial crisis, as you say. Like, the financial crisis hit, you know, the significance of debt and the buildup of debt and corporate and financial debt in particular really hits home. And it's something that the likes of Steve Keane, our mate Steve Keane, and others who have been warning about for years. Like, Steve Keane describes it as the elephant in the living room of economics. Corporate debt's the thing that people, economists, mainstream economists, don't talk about. So that was sort of when we really get into it. And since then, it's been a major area of focus in terms of our political economy education. One of the things that I suppose I'm interested in looking at is sovereign debt. There's been a massive build-up in sovereign debt over the last 10, 20 years, particularly since the financial crisis, but it predates that. And sovereign debt matters more in certain countries, depending on your level of political power, depending on the economic resources you have at your disposal, the position you occupy in the global economy, and the level of exploitation you suffer, as well as the degree of economic sovereignty that you may or may not have. Like, so I'm sure we'll jump into that, but that's one of the things I'm keen to look at.
Yeah, nice one. Nice, important one. Debt's good for some people and very bad for others. Exactly. It depends on your position in the global power structures, I suppose. Stuart, what about you? What does debt mean to you?
Whenever I worked for NatWest, which was a good number of years, back in 1994, I sat down with a wee guy called Robert Park, We both worked at the time in the office of the group chief executive, so we knew quite a bit what was happening in the organization. Parker was an interesting wee thinker, and he said, we have so much debt now out there, in between banks, from banks to individual corporates, the shadow banking system. Each individual bit of debt on its own terms might be completely justifiable, but there's just so much of it in very simple terms. It just takes one wee thing to go wrong to set off a chain reaction, which could take us all into the crapper. Now, this, of course, took a long time to happen, but in 2008, it was there, and many people, not just Park, but later on, including myself, and this was no great insight, saw there was too much debt. Also, you've anticipated me a little bit here by quoting, by talking about Graeber. The Graeber book is good, though. It's somewhat overrated, in my opinion, but there's a very good quote. He says in the book, there's no better way to justify relations founded on violence to make such relations seem moral than by reframing them in the language of debt. Above all, because it immediately makes them seem that it's the victim who is doing something wrong. And I want to talk about debt, both in terms of the sovereign debt issue that Sean was talking about, and also in personal debt as a means of control. The debt that third world countries owe to the West is something that the latter uses to exert control over them. And when you look in America in particular, that is such a heavily indebted population, medical expenses debt, student debt, debt to the bank, people are inclined to be more compliant. So I think we need to talk about debt as a means of social control.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a really important point there. I think it's one of the things Graeber does do really well is show the use of debt over history. And you can even see it today in terms of former colonies of Western powers still paying fucking colonial debt back to their former colonial masters, like 150, 200 years after the end of the colonial system in some parts of the world. So debt is central to the function of modern capitalist societies. That's the first thing that we know. Stuart made the point there's maybe just too much of it. But modern states, as Sean said, modern states are built on deficit spending and on debt. Private sector corporations are in debt to the tune of, I can't remember the latest figures, no doubt you lads will have them, 72 or 73 trillion, whatever that means. And personal debt, of course, in Britain and in Ireland, is a very real and growing problem, particularly during the cost of living crisis. So we'll start there. We'll start where it means most to us, where we see it first, and that's with personal debt, I suppose. And as Stuart said, particularly the idea of personal debt also being a form of social control over working class communities. I remember reading years ago, I think I was doing my O-levels, that's how old I am, and they were doing something about the housing boom in the US in the 1920s. And it's a quote, I think, from Calvin Coolidge, when the first time workers in America got access to cheap credit. And he said, an indebted worker is a disciplined worker. And I never forgot that phrase. And as I grew up and got older and got more into Marxian economics, it kind of made a lot more sense to me. And we've seen that in the neoliberal era as well, haven't we? As that kind of collective response, if you like, that old social democratic collective response to providing the means to live are destroyed or privatized, so that workers therefore are forced to use credit to meet basic needs. And in that sense, we're not living beyond our means. Instead, we're being denied the means to live. And personal debt, I don't know if you have the figures there, lads. I've got the figures in Ireland. It's currently sets at 27 billion for a population of less than 5.5-6 million. If you include mortgages, that's nearly 200 billion, which is basically the same size as the entire sovereign debt of the Republic of Ireland. So, Stu, I'll come to you first. Personal debt, what does it tell us about society and how bad is the situation?
Very broad brush. If you look at the situation up to about 1980, in the States in particular, people were largely debt-free. People got paid decent dosh. After the advent of the neoliberal assault on the working class, again, very broad brush here, real wages remained pretty stagnant or rose very, very insignificantly, whereas you can see from all the figures that debt rose. In the States, credit card debt per capita rose by 1,200% the 1980-2010 period. Household income grew 300%. These are nominal figures, not real figures. People have gone into debt to enable their lifestyle, the lifestyle which is sold them by capitalism, to be maintained. In the States, it's particularly true. It's also true in the United Kingdom as well. This also coincided with a massive relaxation in how much banks could lend and to whom they could lend. Also, banks got into the mortgage business, which they've been largely out of up until the late 70s, early 80s. And that encouraged a significant increase in bank lending for mortgages, which has had its own implications we might talk about later. So, yeah, broad brush, but it's broadly true. We are now borrowing a whole lot more because we don't get paid as much as we used to, and productivity and real wages have been decoupled.
Yeah, Sean, personal debt's not just a, an individual thing, is it, for people to worry about in terms of credit and student loan? It's part of the system. It's why, it's how consumer capitalism is able to function over the last 25, 30 years. It needs us all to be massively in debt to function.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's part of the strategy that was adopted by the capitalist class back in the 1970s and 80s to restore profits. You cut wages, you cut living standards, but you create personal debt as an instrument to prop up those wages and living standards, maintain growth and profit. So it's deeply connected to that strategy.
Is that what we mean when lefties always talk about financialization? Is that what personal debt plays into? Is it part of this process? We always read, don't you, that neoliberalism fundamentally is about deregulation of finance, but also the financialization of society. Are those two concepts linked?
Yeah, well, if you take financialization as one element of the strategy that I'm talking about, the strategy adopted by the capitalist class to strengthen its power and restore its profits. You know, some other elements of the strategy are attacks on unions and wages, the offshoring of production, privatization and austerity, all of that. But debt is one aspect of it. Financialization essentially describes the shift where financial markets and institutions come to dominate the economy. And they cover a whole range of things. Deregulation of the banking sector, which leads to a massive boom in private credit creation and speculative lending. The emergence of new financial institutions and the unregulated shadow banking sector, which is now bigger than the conventional banking sector. That includes the big asset managers like Vanguard and BlackRock. It includes the ability to trade and speculate on currencies, the creation of different financial instruments and packages, and the technologies that enable you to trade them at the speed of light. But crucially, and this is where I'm getting to the point, Stevie, the financialization of everyday life, and that's where we feel it. So in housing, for example, the commodification of housing, the creation of demand for mortgages, the turning of a basic right, a public good, into a financial asset that you speculate on and borrow against. Land speculation, which has a major burn on where we can or can't live. The privatization of pensions. So our dire retirement prospects are massively wrapped up in the stock market and the financial system, and therefore in the continued growth of capitalism. And you have finance moving into different areas like health and stuff. But personal debt is a major part of this. You know, the strategy has been to encourage the growth of personal debt, as I say, to prop up wages and living standards, and so that the growth and profits can be maintained. And as Stuart says, like, it also functions as a method of disciplining workers. Because if you're in debt, you're less likely to take action that's going to put your job in jeopardy. Whether that's joining a union, complaining about your conditions, or even going on strike.
Now, great description, Sean, of financialization and the massive shift we've seen in, particularly in Britain, also in Ireland, I think, but also other European states as well, in terms of the financialization of the economy and the percentage of the economy that's given over to finance as opposed to what we might consider to be traditional capitalist production. Stuart, very briefly on that, what's the link then between that understanding of financialization, which, as Sean said, is one of the characteristics or techniques, if you like, of neoliberalism over the last 40, 50 years? And how does that link to the concept we always talk about of rentier capitalism? I know that it was it Keynes, was it back in the 30s, you said we had to euthanize the rentier. And it was kind of a warning, wasn't it, to the growth in finance above and beyond maybe, you know, capitalist production as we understood it in terms of industry. What do we understand by rentier capitalism, and how's it linked to that financialization process of the last 40 years?
Right, that's a big set of questions. I'll just start by going ahead and adding to what Sean said there. Inflation and financialization, to a large extent, they bear a relationship as well. When you look at the increase in personal debt in this country and the big increase in credit card balances over the last 12 months in particular, the monetarists like to say inflation is everywhere a monetary phenomenon. To a certain extent, they're right. The banks are increasing money supply now because people are having to go into debt to actually pay for stuff. And that's an important point to bear in mind. Regarding financialization, to a certain extent, it can be exaggerated in the UK, but there is no doubt that in the States, the size of the financial sector grew from 2.8% of GDP in 1950 to 21% in 2019, which is a massive increase. In the UK, it's only 8.3% of total economic output, which rose from about, 5.5% in 1990? People talk as if the financial sector here dominates the economy in terms of size, partly because it does in London. We're a very London-centric society. Wait a second. I will, like Sean, eventually get to the point here. But the issue with financialization is that it's more that the priorities of the financial sector come to dominate the economy. You look at investment. It suffered most in America and in the United Kingdom because we have dominant financial sectors that demand short-term returns. And what this leads to as well is a focus on, I guess, exploiting and using financial assets and other assets. Well, that's where we get down to what rentier capitalism is. If you look at the basic definition of rentier capitalism, a rentier is someone who earns income from capital without working, generally done through ownership of assets that generate yield, et cetera, et cetera. There's a great book by Brett Christophers a while ago, which basically expanded the concept. And he talked about this being income derived from ownership, possession, or control of scarce assets under conditions of limited or no competition. And this is when we get to the point. He talks here about the commanding heights of the UK economy: finance, property development, pharmaceuticals, utilities, all rudded with rentierism and particularly exploiting an effective monopoly. Because if you want to go ahead and borrow some money, you'll go to a bank. They all offer pretty much the same services. You can go to your local guy in the council scheme who's going to try and offer you something at much greater than, but there you have an effective quasi-monopoly with the financial sector. And also, last thing on here, which I think is very important that we don't talk about enough, is that the rentier economy has done extremely well over the last 20 years. Study from McKinsey's, not exactly comrades. Low interest rates have increased all asset prices, but particularly real estate. Now, in these 10 countries they covered, home prices tripled on average across these 10 countries because low interest rates, rentier people, rentier capitalists put the money into property. It goes up a hell of a lot. Asset prices relative to income now 50% higher than the long run average. And higher asset prices accounted for over 70% of the growth in net worth in those countries, saving and investment only 28%. So basically, what we have now, the combination of financialization, rentier capitalism, you're incentivizing speculation in assets over real economic investments. Sorry that was so long, but I thought there was some good shit in there.
No, there was some good shit in there. Sean, rentier capitalism, it's always been a feature of capitalism, the growth of capitalism, but is it playing a more negative role even within the capitalist system at the moment than it has historically in terms of driving, as Stuart said, speculation particularly?
Yeah, well, obviously it played a role from the birth of capitalism in terms of ownership and rent of land in particular. But yeah, I think the thing that I would add, like, is that the thing about rent-day capitalism is that it's about making wealthy individuals and companies making income, making profit. Unearned income, they call it in polite terms, from ownership and control of assets and public goods, things that society needs and that we have to pay the privilege for using. So, like, it's housing. There's a massive, massive boom in buy-to-let. For example, big fuck-off institutional landlords buying up large swathes of property just around.
Particularly the case in the Republic of Ireland, of course.
25%, I think it is, of all new housing is bought up by institutional landlords for buy-to-let. Land speculation, obviously a big one. Water is one that we've done a lot of work on. Mm-hmm. You buy the water system and then you just put a fucking toll booth on it, like, and you charge people for the privilege of using what is a natural resource and a public good and something they need to live. Infrastructure, increasingly, we're seeing it in infrastructure. Not just roads and things, airports and things here through PPPs, but particularly in the global south, where you have these big fuck off PPPs being used to finance their country's development needs. And again, the toll booth is massive amounts of interest are charged to those states, and toll booths are installed on the infrastructure. So it's increasingly intellectual property, vaccines. You've seen the price of vaccines doesn't derive from how much it costs to produce. It derives from someone having a monopoly control over it, as Stuart said. They can charge wherever the fuck they want. And then what you have is you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people dying in the global south because they don't have the privilege of accessing it. Like, so it's just control over the things that we need.
It's almost as if capitalism has nothing to do with competition and everything to do with maintaining monopoly power over the things we need to live: land, water, food, medicine, health, education. Stuart, you want to jump in?
Just a great point that Sean made there. I could probably do a whole program about this at some point, but the patent system and the way patent works here and in the States to go ahead and screw people. We need to look at that at some point because it's an important part of the way monopoly capitalism works.
Yeah, it seems as if monopoly capitalism and state monopoly capitalism in particular, it's a huge strategy to transfer wealth from labor to capital. And that seems to be the end result. Strange that. I'm going to move on to talking about another bit of debt now. We've talked about personal debt. It's linked to financialization and, of course, to the concept of rentier capitalism as well and the role that it plays in modern in capitalism generally, particularly in the last 40 years. But also the concept of national debt is really interesting. This one particularly more because of its, not more because of it, but because as well as the role it plays in ideology and politics in terms of how the concept of national debt is used by governments to excuse austerity. That's the big one, I suppose. The British Prime Minister, I think Britain has something like £2 trillion worth of debt. He promised in his, he made these six pointless principles that he was going to bring to bear. And he said that one of the things he wanted to do was pay down the national debt. And this is what we're told is a good thing. We're told that paying down your debts is important for us individually and therefore as a society, as if those two things are the same thing. I mean, debt plays different roles in different parts of the economy. So, Stuart, what would happen, just out of interest for our listeners, what would happen if the British government paid down its £2 trillion debt tomorrow? What would be the consequences to society?
It's a very interesting question. The first thing would be, what would the owners of the debt do with the money? Because they've got all that stuff in a fairly liquid asset and government securities anyway. What would they do with it? Now, they wouldn't spend it all on sweets. They would certainly go ahead and spend some of it in sweets, which could have an inflationary impact, but a lot of that depends on the ability of the economy to absorb that increase in demand. They'd probably go ahead and stick it into other assets, which could cause asset price inflation somewhere else. But the problem is there's ongoing demand for low-risk government assets for them to go ahead and invest in. The states faced this problem a few years ago. There was a genuine belief that because there were so many surpluses under Clinton, that the American national debt could get paid off. So they had an investigation into what to do. A long story short, they basically said that even if they could pay off the national debt, they wouldn't, because government securities enable monetary policy. Right now, the government wants to go ahead and buy some securities, buy back securities, beg your pardon, sell securities, to pursue a particular type of policy. And in certain situations, they might want to buy securities. Also, what do people invest in if you don't have government securities? What they tried to look at in the States was putting together some kind of synthetic government securities based on government agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And that didn't particularly look attractive because, when you look at property, stuff like that, it goes tits up, it goes wrong, and that's what eventually happens. So you'd keep government securities because there's demand for them and they fulfill a useful function in enabling government monetary policy.
But the point there is that if you pay down government debt tomorrow, you might also ruin the fucking economy, because surely, I think as you told me, something like 30% of all government debt is owned by pension schemes. So if that was all paid off, what would happen to those pension schemes, Sean? The point I'm getting to here is that the concept of paying down the national debt is a fucking economic nonsense, is the point, isn't it?
Well, the interesting thing is, and Stuart probably want to elaborate on this, the interesting thing is that the government pays interest on bonds that's linked to a higher rate of inflation, the RPI, and it doesn't do that because it has to. It does it because a lot of private sector pension funds pay benefits linked to the RPI. So it needs that investment to support it. So the government's paying more interest than it needs to effectively to support and back pension funds above and beyond its borrowing requirements. So the government pays that early. It pays down that debt early. It ends that high rate of long-term return that the pension fund is guaranteed. And they have to search elsewhere and do more risky sort of speculative investments to claw it back.
And that's the point, isn't it? Is that the nonsense when Sunak or anybody says they have to pay down national debt ignores the role of debt, ignores what that debt is also made up of, because some of it's pension schemes, some of it is money the government has borrowed from the money markets, from their friends in the money markets. But Stuart, about 30% of that $2 trillion debt is not debt at all, is it?
About 35%, mate, is owned by the fucking government, or by the Bank of England, who are completely 100% government owned. So when you look at that, historically, debt is a pretty low levels in relation to the size of GDP. And also with interest rates, even now, being historically low, borrowing costs are minimal. Sean's quite right there about the whole pension gig. I noticed that whenever, with Kwarteng's ridiculous budget, it set in play a number of hedging strategies that went tits up. And so my pension funds went down dramatically because a large part of them is comprised of government debt because they're risk-free. Government debt is a very important thing to regulate the economy and in terms of investments for old people.
What you said about debt also shows you the way they use the concept of debt and the moral power of debt, back to our first point, to justify austerity, because they can say, oh, the debt's too high, we're at $2 trillion, we need to pay it down. In fact, that's a nonsense. One third of that debt is pensions, one third is owed back to people, but another third of it is owed to their own fucking bank. You know, as we said before on this show, Stuart, what would you do if you owed yourself a tenner? You wouldn't pay it back, or you'd roll it over for the next 20 years. But what it means is that it's not actually debt in a real sense. It's just a fiction. But it shows you the strength of the moral arguments around debt and paying down debts, that the government can come on TV and say that and not be held to account about what exactly the role of national debt is. And that speaks to my next point, just very, very briefly, because there was a report that came out the other day, commissioned by the BBC, yesterday, actually, or day before. And it was and it said that too many journalists lacked an understanding of basic economics. And it came from that Laura Koonsberg, and when she said that the government's credit card was maxed out, which of course is part of that nonsense of fiscal black holes and the government runs out of money because it can only spend money at taxes. And we've covered that. If you don't know what we're talking about, if you listen back to the Magic Money Tree podcast, please, and learn how government finances actually work. And they also highlighted the use of too many household analogies, that Thatcher handbag economic stuff about, well, the government can't spend money it doesn't have and we can only spend the money that we get in through tax. But it was funny, the BBC, such were the complaints over Laura Koonsberg's, the government's credit card was maxed out, they've had to commission this report. I doubt that'll change, and I doubt that'll affect the economic literacy of many of their reporters. There was one bloke once, about 18 months ago, who mentioned modern monetary theory on a late-night BBC report, and he actually says, well, the government borrows from its own banks, so really that's not debt at all, and he's never been seen again. I think they just disappeared him. He's probably lying in a fucking ditch somewhere.
I think they generally believe it's too complicated for people to understand. I remember during the war in former Yugoslavia, the head of the Bosnian army was actually a Serb. And the BBC never reported that because they thought that, well, the public can't fucking take all that. And I think there's that element there. And I think quite a few do not understand that it's not a household. Also, they're pursuing a particular agenda. Austerity was all bullshit about basically doing the working class down, as it was in the early 80s, destroying the trade union movement. What they never talk about is that not just a matter of paying off the government debt completely. If the government runs a fiscal surplus, it's taking money out of the rest of the economy. You need to see the economy as basically a function of flows between various sectors. The government runs a surplus, it means the rest of us don't have cash. And that's not what we need right now.
Yeah, but then I remember during the discussions within the Labour Party of 2016-17, and John McDonnell was having those discussions, wasn't he, about QE for the people and about talking about government finances openly in the way you've just talked about it. And they decided internally, no one will believe us, we can't sell that. And so they went back to basically austerity light as their policy, which is now the main policy of the Starmerites. Such is the hold, and this is the point, such is the hold of these neoliberal myths about how the economy works, Sean, that, you know, the BBC won't challenge those kind of shibboleths, and they won't talk about economics as it really happens. One, because it suits the establishment and they're part of it, but two, maybe people won't believe it because the popular discourse, that these kind of prejudices or understandings of neoliberalism and how the economy works are so embedded in popular discourse, it's hard to shift them. Would you agree?
Yeah, and to the extent, as you said, that the British Labour Party has basically accepted that it'll continue to implement Tory austerity if and when it comes into government. You know, they've committed to continuing with what the Tory government starts in terms of its austerity programme. Partly because they represent the left wing of capital and partly because they're not prepared to challenge those myths.
Yeah. And what about, Sean, you said you wanted to throw in something about Europe, about what's debt in Europe and the role of the European Union or the ECB.
Yeah, I suppose, like, we're talking about the US and Britain, which are two sovereign currency issuing countries that can't run out of money. So the debt, the sort of dynamics around debt are quite different from what they are within the Eurozone. Eurozone member states don't have that power. So I just thought...
Well, they do. They've just ruled against it in one of the treaties, but carry on.
Yeah. Yeah, so I just thought it would be worth mentioning the fact that public debt in the Eurozone has massively increased over the course of the pandemic. So in Spain, Greece and Italy, as well as some of the Eastern member states, public debt is now higher than it was at the height of the last crisis. Italy alone, but I read somewhere, has 2.8 trillion euros of debt. And the thing about Italy is big enough to trigger a major crisis across the whole Eurozone if it starts to default. It's looking increasingly like that might be the case. So you have these countries facing the health crisis isn't over. Governments are facing increased pressure on budgets. The same EU member states are paying the price for their involvement in the war in Ukraine, both directly and then through the cost of food and energy. They're facing into a global recession. And all of this means their borrowing needs are going to increase. So the thing about it is there's no agreement within the EU on anything really, apart from the general neoliberal direction in which it's headed. But there's no agreement in terms of fiscal policy, fiscal transfers between the core and the periphery, on monetary policy, nothing of that nature. So the question is, what is the response of the European institutions if and when this crisis arises? The ECB holds 40% of the public debt, but seems committed to hiking interest rates into this year and next. It's not only ending its bond buying programs, but actually selling off the bonds that it holds, which threatens to unravel the whole thing. So the question is, how does the European institutions respond to the onset of a crisis like this? They're all at loggerheads.
Yeah, you wouldn't be surprised to see two Eurozones emerge, a core and a periphery, or in fact, I'm sure the Germans have access to the Deutschmark printing presses somewhere, deep in the bowels of the German central bank. I don't think they're too far away. There were talks about that, of course, back in 2009 and 10, genuine talks, public talks about people going back to national currencies because the Eurozone was fucked. But that crisis that occurred in the Eurozone 2008, 2009, they just kicked the can down the road. You could argue they've done that everywhere. The difference is the US and Britain, because they're sovereign currency issuing states and have their own central banks, they had responses, and they have responded in ways that the ECB haven't been able to, because they have, I can't remember which treaty is, but it's one of those treaties on the running of the European Union where they have an article saying, we're not printing money, we're not engaging in that kind of activity. And so they're in the position they are because of their own ordo-liberal rules that suit, as you said, France, Germany, and some of the other smaller countries in Northern Europe. Lads, we've talked about sovereign debt, we've talked about national debt. There's another debt that, personal debt, the other one that's rarely talked about, and you said it, Sean, that Steve King called it the elephant in the room of capitalism, and that's corporate debt, private debt. And we need to talk about corporate debt, I suppose. Corporate debt has risen dramatically since 2008, when it was already at a fucking massive high due to the access to easy money and private banks and shadow banks issuing all sorts of credit. Are we at the end now of cheap money and the issuing of credit? And so what's the consequence of that in terms of companies being able to pay back the massive debts they already owe? I know that, Sean, you're a big fan of zombie companies, and I'm going to come to you first just in that idea of how bad can things get, considering that world, I think that I've got one figure in front of me that private corporate debt rose to 92% of world GDP by 2018. So we're in massive amounts of debt. And I want to come to you, Sean, on the first question, which is zombie companies, what are they and what do they represent? And also then over to you, Stuart, because I know you want to talk about the role of Chinese corporate debt as well, specifically in that picture. Sean, tell us a little about corporate debt and how bad things could get.
Yeah, the corporate debt figure is actually higher than the ones you have now.
I'm not surprised.
That they're corporate, non-financial corporate debt. That's companies that make and sell things effectively. Their debt is 97% of world GDP. It's about 87.5 trillion, I think I read, which is.
And is that debt ever getting paid back?
Never.
No. So some people don't have to pay their debt. So just throw that one in there. Carry on.
Yeah. So the corporate sector and the financial sector has been living off cheap money for the last 10, 12 years, since the financial crisis in particular.
And by cheap money for our listeners, that's money that's just cheap to borrow, basically, the low levels of interest rates on it.
Yeah, and there's a massive injection of cheap credit in the wake of the financial crisis to try to prop up sectors within the economy. It's this cheap money that's fueled unproductive investment. It hasn't really got into productive investment, but more into speculation, into propping up asset prices and propping up the stock market. to the extent that the stock market's now valued at 15 times the actual value of the companies that it represents, which is just fucking ludicrous.
That sounds like a bubble, Sean.
The question was always like, what happens if and when the era of cheap money ends? If you've said, like, people like Steve Keen have been warning about the build-up of corporate debt over these years. They're saying this is the makings of a major crisis down the line. And it looks like we're actually entering into the phase now where a combination of high interest rates and the global recession could trigger this major crisis at a time when the central banks are starting to pull back. So the question is, what is the response to that? Can the system continue to be propped up in the way that it has? And yeah,
or are we looking at what they like to call a slight market correction on a global scale?
On zombie, just zombie companies very quickly. Zombie companies are firms that aren't making enough money to service their debt. So as it stands, there's about 15% of all companies meet this definition. If you take out the high growth companies, which is basically tech firms front loaded with debt, but growing quickly and expect it to become more profitable, then it's about 10%. So 10% of all firms in the OECD are zombie companies. These firms are generally quite small. They're thought to be a drag on the economy because they're not investing, obviously. They're just about meeting some of their debts. And obviously, they're really vulnerable to the kind of interest rate hikes that we've seen and vulnerable to the impact of recession. So without the kind of support that they've got to date, you know, through cheap money, through the private capital markets, through bond buying programs by the central banks, can these companies survive? And it's likely that they'll be the first to go under. The thing about it is they do employ a fairly large number of people. I think in America they employ 2.2 million people. So if they were all to go under, that would increase unemployment by 50%. So I think we're looking at a scenario where they would be the first to go under in the case of in the onset of a major economic recession. Or they'd be bought over.
Stuart, you wanted to come in there, but also I wanted you to address the issue because I know you were interested in what role does Chinese corporate debt play in that scenario of a potential coming crisis in terms of the corporate sector globally being unable to pay back the 97% of equivalent to world GDP of debt that it's carrying at the moment?
Just on the zombie companies, the official definition of zombie companies, zombies that can't cover the interest on their borrowing from operating profit for 3 years in a row. That's a pretty serious situation. Number of zombie companies in the UK grew by 10% in 2022. Now, according to this definition, zombie companies account for 5% of all firms globally, accounting for nearly $400 billion in debt. And interestingly enough, and this gets onto the Chinese issue again, around 9% of real estate developers and 11% of diversified real estate companies are afflicted with apparent zombieism. In China, first thing to remember is about 31% of all corporate debt is Chinese corporate debt, which is fucking huge and, of course, does present a huge number of problems. Generally speaking, I think economists are reasonably optimistic because they think that the corporate world globally and also in China is in a good enough shape to be able to pay these debts off without a systemic problem arising. Economists have got it wrong before. Very few forecast what happened in 2008. Recent figures show that global corporate debt fell slightly this year, mostly down to people in the energy industry. Obviously, made quite a bit of cash. They're paying some debts off. And it's interesting that as interest rates increase, debt does show a tendency to go down, except in America. It's part of the culture there. They'll basically borrow money. But even there, it will taper off a little bit. So the figures don't concern that many people at the moment. To be honest, I'm a little bit more concerned about the balance sheet effect. If you get a lot of companies working to pay off debt, they're not investing in shit elsewhere. They're not actually building up the businesses. And this is going to happen in China almost certainly. There will be kind of like a, maybe not a balance sheet recession, but a balance sheet inspired downturn across China. And China has become quite important. The systemic risk thing that worries me more right now will be what's happening in the property market here and across the globe. When you look at It was quite an interesting thing in the New Statesman yesterday. Not often they said that, but they were talking about the impact of falling property prices. Something like half the book of a bank like Santander, not Bank Santander, I think it's more, but about half the book, the lending book of British banks is residential mortgage. And a lot of that's in the buy-to-let market as well. If you get a significant downturn there, which threatens the bank balance sheets, I think there's probably enough buttress now in those balance sheets to avoid a systemic problem, but it will affect their ability and their willingness to lend money elsewhere. And that will have an impact on the corporates. And because everything is so interconnected, right, then that can lead to a greater systemic problem. We can probably get away with it without a major catastrophe, but it will certainly increase the tendencies we already have towards stagnation. Does that all make sense?
That does make sense, yeah. I mean, the idea of long-term stagnation and no to low growth in the capitalist economy seems to be the picture for the next 10 years, which, of course, is not good for workers and not good for communities at all. Like, you know, but it'd be interesting to see how governments respond to this, because they don't seem to have any other levers they can pull in order to dig them. Well, there are other, but that means moving and transforming ourselves into a sustainable, green and socialist economy. There are things you could do, because there's lots of things need to be done, and states can invest in those things and pay for those things to be done, but not the states you have at the moment. Sean, before we go, because I know we're coming close to the end of our pod here, we can't talk about debt and not talk about the influence of debt on the global south. And we talked at the start about personal debt, and personal debt being a form of social control the capital has over workers by collapsing their living standards and their wages, and then forcing workers to take on credit, which then, you know, buries them, if you like, and restricts their ability to be active political agents in defense of their own interests, because they're in debt and they're afraid. There's a similar impact, isn't it, on the global south and the relationship between the north or the west, if you like, and the global south in terms of debt.
Yeah, like, I'm sure a lot of people have seen reports of building sovereign debt problems in the global south. So I suppose there's two questions, like, why are countries of the global south so indebted, and who's benefiting from country that indebtedness? And the answer to both of those questions is imperialism. So to begin with the first question, countries in the global south aren't only living with a legacy of colonialism, they're living through an ongoing process of imperialism, from imperialist exploitation and control. So there's a study produced by Jason Hickel a couple of years ago, and he found that between 1990 and 2015 alone, there was a total of $242 trillion drained from the global south to the global north through the appropriation of labour, land and natural resources. Now, we'll maybe get into how that takes place in a later discussion on imperialism, but that's the facts of the matter. What this drain on resources does is two things. It goes to subsidise a higher standard of living in the global south through profits, wages to some extent, but particularly through the excess consumption of the rich. And it forces countries of the global south into debt servitude, precisely because they're deprived of the resources to invest in their local economies and to meet local need. So over the last 20 years, the external debt of low-income countries in the global south, has more than doubled to $15 trillion.
That's even after the so-called debt jubilee of the early noughties.
Yeah, from 2000 to 2022, or 23 now, it's doubled from about $7.5 trillion to $15 trillion. There's 54 countries in the global south, mainly in Africa, but not exclusively. They're already in debt crisis. Officially in a debt crisis, and there's another 15 headed in the same direction, which is like a third of the world's population. Now, there's a few things to note about this. The first is that these countries were already paying more interest than they're actually receiving in loans and the aid combined. Now they're facing interest rates that have doubled in the last 6 to 9 months. So that's a doubling, and the debt of these countries is mainly denominated in US dollars, which means they're at the mercy of US monetary policy. And the interest rate hikes in the US has doubled the interest rates that they're facing from 3 to 6%. And that's like billions in real terms of a hike that they're facing. The second thing to note is that there's been a massive increase. Like, there's a lot of talk about China and China's role in Africa in particular through those public-private type partnership, developmental type deals. Now, China's role in providing credit to the global south has increased, but nowhere near as much as the increase in private credit to the global south. Between a half and two thirds of the total debt owned by low and middle income countries is owed to private financial institutions that are based largely in London and New York. And this is the result of a deliberate strategy by the West to encourage, to force countries of the global south into this type of borrowing, which is typically much more extortionate. That typically has much higher interest rates. And the third thing, I suppose, to say is that the states that are in debt distress represent more than 50% of people living in extreme poverty. So we're talking about large African states like Kenya, Ethiopia, Ghana, as well as countries in Asia like Pakistan. These are countries living with a legacy of colonialism. As I said, the continuing impact of imperialism in the form of economic extraction and exploitation. They're countries with increasing social needs in terms of demographics, population increase, health needs, education needs, infrastructure needs. They're countries that are disproportionately affected by climate breakdown through no fault of their own. Pakistan recently had to go to the IMF on the account of the natural disaster, the climate sort of extreme weather events that they faced, and had to borrow $120 million just to deal with the fallout of that disaster. Not to invest structurally or anything of that nature, just to deal with the fallout of that disaster. And of course, there'll be strict conditionality attached to that loan, judging by the IMF's track record in Latin America and Africa to date. So we're not just talking about like an economic problem, a potential economic crisis. Like, this is a human catastrophe that we're facing in the next year or two.
But Sean, as we said at the start of the podcast, I mean, everyone has to pay their debts, you know. You can't just be giving money to people and not pay their debts. Unless, of course, you're a private corporation, or unless you're an individual entrepreneur who can just declare themselves bankrupt and set up a business the next day, or pass on that fucking debt to somebody else. Stuart, we're going to give you the last word on that. Sean just gave a very good description of the imperial relationship between the imperial core in the West and the global South. Something, of course, the Social Democrats refuse to accept even exists and doesn't believe. What about our exploitation and extraction of profits from the global South?
I got to say, that was a magnificent little piece by Sean there, which has anticipated much of what I was going to say. I will just go ahead.
Well, feel free not to repeat it, but just give us some choice remarks of your own.
I will just give some historical background, which will put it in context and will eventually answer your question too. You got to remember, all this happened began in the mid-70s with the huge amount of money the Arab countries earned from the increase in the price of oil. As part of the settlement, some believe, that the Americans made with the Arab countries, basically not to try and take on Israel again for a little while in the return of Sinai, that money went to the Wall Street banks, who began to lend it to the countries in Africa and Latin America in particular. The people that arranged those loans got paid a huge amount of money. $100 billion loan, you get 1%, you're going to do pretty well out of it. The bourgeoisie and the people in the Latin American countries, they liked it because they took an awful lot off it. One of the consequences has been that the progress Latin American and African countries made in import substitution, etc., before this lending took place, was completely sidetracked, because whenever the loans ran into problems, they had the debt, the structural adjustment programs, the IMF, the World Bank, all that bullshit, imposition of neoliberalism, and they had to open up. They had to open up their economies to the West. So they become purely commodities exporters again. They have to go ahead and focus on commodities to go ahead and get fucking dollars to pay off their debts. And the cycle of poverty continues. So this is why progress they made in the immediate years after World War II, and now they're on their ass again. And a deliberate policy, I'm not into conspiracy theories, but there is no doubt that various things did come together, which helped them reinstitute neo-colonialist imperialism and the economic dominance of the developing world.
Well, you've just described perfectly how debt as a form of social control is part of the imperialist relationship between the West and the global South. And as Sean said, we are going to come back to this issue. We did have a discussion before Christmas that we wanted to do a series of podcasts on imperialism. to describe its, as Marxist, to describe its history and our understanding of it and its role in that imbalance of power across the planet and what it says about the next 20, 30 years. So we're going to do that. We're going to come back. We're going to have a series of pods on imperialism. I hope you enjoyed today's pod, our little dip of our toes into the concept of debt, complicated issue that exists on multiple levels in terms of personal debt, in terms of state debt, in terms of private debt, but also particularly debt as a form of social control, not just against workers, but also against large parts of the planet. So I hope you enjoyed that. Tune in for more. We'll see you all again. Slagle for that, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and slagle for.